go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Brethren and sistren, it is a prayer meeting miracle. I tell you what, a prayer meeting miracle. Truly it is. It was only an hour ago, brethren and sistren, when the inner tubes went down. And they seemed, brethren and sistren, that they are going to stay down. But y'all's been a-praying. You've been a-praying and lifting us up in prayer. And, well, we's back. We's back. And so, too, is apparently a hornet. I hope he's a good Christian hornet and decides not to sting my pale pink hide during the program. Help! Help! Now, you just go on, Mr. Hornet. We're all God's creatures. But you'll be a lot happier being a creature that's nowhere near me. All right? Good. Bless you. Hey, it's Wednesday. That's right, that's right. Not just hump day, not just downhill to Friday, middle of the week. No, 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 no. It's prayer meeting Wednesday on the horn, brother and sister. Hallelujah. Glory. And I want to remind you, as we prepare to pass the plate around, that we are $110 away from meeting Waggy's challenge from last night, which will help us a long way toward finishing May and April in the black, brethren and sisters. We was about $700 away when we started last night. And thanks to folks like Waggy and Darlene and Kate, we are now significantly closer to that goal, but we are $110 away from meeting Waggy's challenge. So if you'll note that little old PayPal button down there in the bottom of the sort of brassy, bronzy plate that'll be passing amongst the pews here in a little bit, you might just push that button, or you can use the traditional blessed mail address as well. That's one of the horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, Paul Mary Bubba, 318 Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801, and it keeps there when you use the traditional overland, over air, neither rain nor sleet nor snow mail address. I have to let you know it makes Boss Man Wayne very happy, because that way the mailbox don't echo. Alrighty? Mm-hmm. So as we prepare for this here prayer meeting Wednesday, brethren and sisters, we will call the minister of music forward for our offertory hymn, with every head bowed and every eye closed, except for the eyes needed to reach for the plate as it comes around you, because it makes a terrible clanking noise if you ain't watching, and it falls to the floor, bangs upon one of the pews. Anyway, Brother Minister of Music, if you would please.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free.
Hallelujah!
Hallelujah! Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Oh, Hutsuck, Boston on the real raw, and a brawl to sue it. I love you. Hallelujah, glory. Welcome to this here prayer meeting Wednesday on the horn, brethren and sistren. We done chased the deacons out from the parking lot. Where they's out there smoking with the sinners, and we goaded them and guided them in through the vestibule, past that bowl of 20-year-old butter mints, and they done come on down and took their seats at the front of the cathedral here, whereas I can see them when they begin to nod off. So that means it's time for you, brethren and sisters, to come on down that blood-red aisle and fall on your knees and lay your hands on the subwoofer there at the altar, brethren and sistren, and feel the healing rays of common sense a-flowing through you from the server on high. This here is the cathedral of common sense, brethren and sistren. Glory! And I am Archpope Uber Rabbi, inspired imam, animated atheist, antagonized agnostic, animated animist Bob Kincaid, and glory, we are gonna have a soul-stirring time this year, prayer meeting Wednesday. Glory, 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 amen and amen. Worlds without end. Miracle worker Agnes is back here behind me. If you hear me making any scary noises, she's back here with her can of miraculous spray starch, trying to I don't know, starch a hornet or a mud dauber or whoever that fella is that's in here that ain't got no business being in here. I got nothing against him or nothing. I'd just be happy for him to be on the outside world and me right here on the inside. But he may be a demonic hornet or mud dauber or such like, because he ain't cooperating. You stomp him, Agnes? Oh, he's a demonic little greasy spot now. With heavy starch. Goodness me. What a way to begin this here prayer meeting Wednesday. You know, I should have done knowed better. I should have knowed better. There I was last prayer meeting Wednesday getting all excited because the new Pope Dunn said that the atheist was redeemed as well. And apparently, that whole infallibility thing is getting rethought. Because, you know, it don't mean that he never stubs his toe, infallibility. Nur says, damn it, when he hits his thumb with a hammer. It means that his pronouncements regarding the church are automatically right. He just gets to be right all the time. Unless he says that the atheist is redeemed too, in which case there is a Reverend Thomas Rossica out there who flogs away when the Pope says something unpopey, and you may recall what the Pope said on the radio box last week was, the Lord has redeemed all of us, not just Catholics, everyone, even the atheists, everyone. Well, that didn't sit too well with Reverend Rossica. Because, and apparently he, a miracle done took place, and he, he got himself the ability to read the Pope's mind. And he said, Pope Francis has no intention of provoking a theological debate on the nature of salvation through his homily or scriptural reflection when he stated that God has redeemed all of us with the blood of Christ, all of us, not just Catholics, everyone. This means, and here's where he goes to explaining what the Pope really meant. Oh, mercy. This here means that all salvation comes from Christ, the head, through the church, which is his body. Hence, they cannot be saved who, knowing the church as founded by Christ and necessary for salvation, would refuse to enter her or remain in her. We got some troubling metaphors going on here, Father. At the same, would refuse to enter her or remain in her. I wonder if you typed that one-handed, Reverend. At the same time, thanks to Christ and to his church, those who through no fault of their own do not know the gospel of Christ and his church, but sincerely seek God and move by grace, try to do his will, and as it is unknown through the dictates of conscience, can attain eternal salvation. What that basically boils down to is you atheists are still going to fry, you dumb bastards. That's what he's saying there. But there's some stuff that underlies it, too. So is the Baptists and the Pentecostals and the Freewillers and the Mormons and the Jews and the Muslims and the Buddhists and the Baha'is and the Jains and the animated animists. And everybody going to fry. Everybody going to fry if you ain't a Catholic. That's tough. That's tough. I should have knowed better. I should have knowed better. I should have knowed better than to think we'd be having any common decency in a religious dialogue. Nope. Atheists, you're cooking. Might as well just go ahead and start buttering yourself up, because you're going to roast for eternity down in hell while people like good Pope Frank and Pope John Paul and Jerry Falwell and Lester Maddox and George Wallace and Billy Graham and Richard Nixon and Hitler and sit around singing hosannas in heaven. Wow. Yeah, should have known better. Always should know better. Anytime the religious people start acting like maybe they're not as hate-filled as they actually are. Because they are. They're hate-filled. But it would not be, it absolutely would not be Prayer Meeting Wednesday if we didn't have a message from the Blessed Patois. You may recall on this year program last week, we played a little audio of Patois Robertson telling a lady whose husband had gone out and went a romping on her, not on her, but with some other woman. The point is, they wasn't romping, and he told her she needed to be thankful that he was letting her live in his house, and she needed to make herself absolutely desirable to her philandering Christian hubby. Well, that went around the internet like through a goose. And apparently, Marion, that's his real name, Marion Robertson, didn't take too kindly to it. No, he did not.
We want to take some time to answer email questions.
All right.
But
and Terry, I want to make a statement here. This part of our program, ladies and gentlemen, I answer specific questions from specific people, and my attempt as a pastor is to help them have a better life.
Well, I'm glad we got that cleared up, but what the hell does it mean?
And to have an answer to their question. But there are organizations, there's one in particular, which I will not name.
The horn, Pat. Have you noticed us, Pat? Have you started your imprecatory praying, Pat? Oh, no, it ain't us. We're too little tiny. we are not worthy of his notice. No, he's pretty much talking about Right Wing Watch, which is where all this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful audio comes from. Because somebody takes one for the team every time Pat gets on the air and sits there and watches for the crazy to come out. I couldn't do it. I could not do it. But somebody does. Some antagonized agnostic does. And then you get stuff like this.
But it is set out for one purpose, to embarrass those who are conservative on television. And so they take my words and twist them and distort them.
Now, see, that's the funny thing. If you go back to last Wednesday's program, you can hear the patois. And nothing's distorted. The question gets read by Cruella, or the Nancy Grace's baby sister, or whoever this is sitting over across from him. She reads him the question, and he starts giving his godly, upstanding, moral, righteous answer. That quote from last week was missing some things. It really was. It was missing brains and common decency, and anything even remotely resembling a respect for the female half of our little human species experiment here, is missing a lot of stuff. But it was just swimming in context. There's context all over the place. So Pat's upset. He says they're taking him out of context. Of course, that's what right-wingers say whenever they get caught saying something mean, hateful, dumb, and stupid, and get called on it. Well, you took me out of context. No, like I said, you's just a swimming in it, Pat, that context.
To embarrass those who are conservative on television, and so they take my words and twist them and distort them. But nevertheless, we have had some wonderful responses to the last time they played that game with me. And you've got a letter that came I thought was real precious, and I want just to let you see what some of the people are saying.
Okay, this.
Okay, you might want to strap in and get the tennis ball and the duct tape for this.
Letter. This is a viewer who writes Pat and says, "Dear Pat, your answer regarding the woman who's having an extremely difficult time forgiving her husband of his infidelity is in line with how God tells us to forgive."
Do tell. Putting on something trashy and rubbing around on him and trying to forget all them nights that he was out there romping with that other woman. That's in line with how God tells us to forgive. I think we've got another hymn coming up.
"I heard no excuse for the man's poor behavior in your answer to her. What I did hear..."
That must have been the time when she accidentally hit the mute button when she was sitting there in her moo-moo on the couch.
"And understand from you is that no amount of counseling, talking to friends, or trying to forgive will lead her toward healing and moving forward. Actions such as the ones you suggested, which is to focus on the positive and why she was drawn to her husband initially, is the absolute best route to recovery. God forgives us in the..."
You ever get the idea that maybe the woman writing this note is the Bathsheba that the hubby was romping with in the first place? It sounds kind of suspicious-like.
"The same manner a million times a day, and he commands us..."
Well, a million times a day, I don't know about you, but a million times a day, I'm not out of romping with somebody who ain't Agnes. Nor you with yours, man or woman. Yeah.
us to do the same. God bless you. And she signs this. A woman who wishes she'd received this same advice on forgiveness prior to her divorce 15 years ago.
I told you, I told you, I told you. Just saying.
And then she quotes 2 Corinthians 10:5 and Matthew 6:14 and 15.
She wishes she'd had those same advice. Folks, we're here to help you. But believe me, there are people who aren't. I am not politically correct, in case you haven't learned.
Now, we all remember what politically correct means when a right-winger says it. That means that I feel like I am being oppressed. Here I am sitting around in all my white male privilege just to having it roll off me like water off a duck's back. And I don't like it when people point out that I'm mean and hateful and dumb and stupid and bigoted and racist and phobic and homophobic and transphobic and that's because you're making me be politically correct if I can't say ugly things without getting criticized. See, nobody's stopping him from saying these ugly things. This is just a matter of him being intolerant for the pushback that he gets when he does say the ugly thing. What a pissant.
I tell it like it is.
People misconstrue.
No, I just told it like it is, Pat.
Sometimes, often, no, people misconstrue.
This organization that misconstrues deliberately. They want to do everything they can to make my words, and they twist them.
Now, I've been working around audio equipment, and I've been practicing the art of word knowing since about 48 years ago. And I have yet to figure out how to twist a word. I mean, you used to get those little BB bat suckers when you were a kid, and when they got in the warm sun, you could twist them and curl them and make corkscrews out of them or what. But words, I mean, if you just record it and you play it back, well, bust my buttons, but I have yet to figure out how that's twisting. But it might have something to do with the fact that Pat Robertson is a pathological liar. You know, makes stuff up to be pretty much making stuff up. After you spend a generation or two telling people that you know what God says, after a while you begin to sort of blur that line between you and God. It's like that old bumper sticker. If your God hates all the same things you do, he's probably made up. He's your invisible friend. Your invisible, incredibly bigoted, hateful, bloodthirsty friend.
First thing, I will not identify the organization, but one day we may have a full-scale expose because it's a nasty group.
Oh, they're going to do full-scale expose? Thank you, Right Wing Watch. And if it should turn out to be Media Matters, thank you, Media Matters. They asked Josh Glastetter, who is People for the American Way's research director, and People for the American Way is who runs rightwingwatch.org. Remember, it was started by People for the American Way was started by Norman Lear, because Norman Lear got rather tired of the filth that was spewing from the likes of Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, et al. So upon being told what Pat Robertson had said, Josh Glastetter of People for the American Way said, Pat Robertson doesn't understand how ridiculous and extreme he sounds to a mainstream audience. For decades, he's lived inside the bubble of the Christian Broadcasting Network. Right Wing Watch faithfully reports Robertson's comments and provides appropriate context. There's that context again. You can't walk from here to there without tripping over a bunch of context anytime you're over there at Right Wing Watch. There's no need to twist and distort his words to make them sound crazy or offensive, Glastetter continued. They are inherently both. He also noted, as far as that full-scale expose was concerned, Robertson can't threaten us into silence. He's been attacking our founder, Norman Lear, for decades and even blamed us for the 9/11 terrorist attacks. We take his outbursts as a badge of honor. Well, exactly. Exactly. But what's interesting is that here the patois is, and you know, he's got money that has money. I mean, he's got enough money that he could burn a herd of sopping wet elephants with $100 bills. In other words, spaceship money, or in this case, lawyer money. And here's how you know that Pat Robertson is full of poo. Screw the expose, Pat. Sue People for the American Way and Right Wing Watch for defamation. Sue them. March right into court and sue them for reporting the words that you have actually spoken in the name of your imaginary, hateful, bigoted, bloodthirsty, miserable God. Sue them. Take them to court. Present the evidence in front of a jury, tried and true. There's only one problem. He won't. Because, see, there's this doctrine in American law. It's a maxim of sorts. I said, no, it's actually bright black-letter law in America. And it goes like this. Are you ready? You might want to write this down. Truth is an absolute defense. By absolute defense means ain't no way around it. His buddy, Jerry Falwell, who instead of being in heaven singing hosannas with Hitler, is probably in hell roasting, getting basted on a spit, even as we speak, with the demons turning the crank. I think he's about done, Daddy. Jerry Falwell tried it. And he tried it against Larry Flint. And Larry Flint, as debilitated as he is, beat Jerry Falwell like a barred mule. Beat him like he owed him money. And in the case, you may recall, in the case of Larry Flint, it wasn't a matter of just posting a recording of something that Jerry Falwell had actually said. In the case of Larry Flint and Hustler and Jerry Falwell, they did an ad, a parody satire ad for Campari and soda, I think it was, in which the parody ad, and Campari had, whoever the liquor was, had been advertising, tell us about your first time. And it was all about the first time you ever had a Campari and soda or whatever. Well, no, not so much. The folks at Hustler turned that on its head, and instead told a story in this mock-up of the ad all about how Jerry Falwell had got liquored up and had sex with his mama. And the Supreme Court said, you know, we're either going to have a First Amendment or we're not. Jerry Falwell's a public figure who has put himself out into the public space, and he's open for that kind of stuff. And then they did some moralizing about how odious and nasty it was and whatnot, yada, yada, yada. And then they said, judgment. Judgment for Mr. Flint and Hustler. Thank you. Goodbye now. Lord, Jerry, you might not ought to have brought this one because I think they're going to wear you out. And then Larry Flint proceeded to do so. So if that won't get you busted under defamation or any other theory of a speech tort, guess what? Posting the actual words of Marion Robertson, hell, they wouldn't get in the courthouse door before they was bouncing out in the other direction and hitting their little tuckuses on the courthouse steps. Get out, right? Yeah. So there's that. But it is prayer meeting Wednesday, and we are far from done. But yes, the Spirit has moved me with that reminder from that lovely email from the lady talking about how she didn't hear nothing wrong with what Pat said. Well, I've just got an awful, awful mind. I was immediately put in mind of this little hymn. this little hymn about, well, the things that people do. No, I didn't want that. Daggum. I want this. Yeah. Get up. Dance a little.
Sitting in a tiny table in a ritzy restaurant. She was staring at her coffee cup. He was trying to keep his courage up by applying booze. Talk was small and they talked at all. They both knew what they wanted. There was no need to talk about it. They were bold enough to scope it out.
Here it comes.
She said, you don't look like my type, but I guess you'll do. Third grade romance, low rent rendezvous. He said, I'll even tell you that I love you if you want me to.
From the boys in the band, the Amazing Rhythm Aces, Hallelujah, and Third Rate Romance, Low Rent Rendezvous. Of course, they got another great one out there called Lipstick Traces. It's a dandy as well. But couldn't you see Philander and Hubby out there, all full of the love of Jesus, going in and registering at the Family Inn? Did you catch that? They went to the Family Inn, and she said, "Give me the key," and I. Mercy. This coming in from Jan. Last night, men plus barbecues equals boring. Well, I'm sorry, but sometimes the crazy just gets a little too thick. Jim asking, what is wrong with the Campari ad? I love the stuff. Great aperitif, Bob. Jim, it's not about the aperitif and whether or not it is good. It was the story about how they took the Campari ad campaign and used it against Jerry Falwell by suggesting that he got liquored up and had sex with his mama. And even that was found to not be actionable by the Supreme Court of the United States in a case called Falwell v. Hustler. Oh, well, that's just charming. Two pieces of breaking news. One, from the, well, and we're really surprised by this, why department. Breaking news, Obama to pick James B. Comey, former Bush official, to lead FBI. James B. Comey, as the breaking news story from the New York Times notes, is a hedge fund executive and former senior Justice Department official under President George W. Bush. And he's going to replace Robert S. Mueller as the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Oh, this will work nicely. Oh, listen to how the for-profit media described this. By choosing Mr. Comey, a Republican, Mr. Obama made a strong statement about bipartisanship at a time when he faces renewed criticism from Republicans in Congress and has had difficulty confirming some important nominees. Oh, for pity's sakes. You may remember James Comey from that nasty little episode in which Alberto Torture Boy Torquemada Gonzalez went to the bedside of then Attorney General Crisco John Ashcroft, who was suffering from a nasty bout of pancreatitis, and it is nasty. The Times describes him as a critical player in 2004 in the dramatic hospital room episode in which the White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, and Mr. Bush's chief of staff, Andrew Card, tried to persuade Attorney General John Ashcroft, who was ill and disoriented. Disoriented means whacked out of his mind on Lortab or Vicodin or maybe even oxycodone. If you're the Attorney General, you probably have oxy. To reauthorize a warrantless eavesdropping program. And yes, in that all that ugly business, Mr. Comey was the one who stepped in to try to stop that nasty bit of chicanery. And as a result, Crisco John refused to reauthorize the warrantless wiretapping, eavesdropping, domestic spying program. I guess President Obama thinks, well, you know, maybe they'll confirm this guy. He's a Republican. Great expectations, Mr. President. Great expectations. You really think they're going to do that? If you, Mr. Obama, please, if you nominated Jesus H. Christ, you know, the God, not the guy from Mexico. If you nominated Jesus H. Christ to be director of the FBI, Mitch McConnell would be standing there saying, nope, ain't gonna happen. And then this, significantly more disturbing. Texas Betsy just sent this along. Letter sent to New York Mayor Bloomberg and referencing support of gun control preliminarily tests positive for ricin. Well, there's another one of those little moments where somebody wasn't very good at headline writing. Because if you just read that headline, you would think that the ricin poison assassination attempt on Mayor Michael Bloomberg supported gun control, wouldn't you? Now listen again. Letter sent to New York Mayor Bloomberg and referencing support of gun control preliminarily tests positive for ricin. Now, of course, that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Michael Bloomberg, whatever else he is, is very much concerned about the proliferation of firearms in America's cities, including the one of which he is mayor, New York. Okay. This is by... when you get to the link, the actual headline is, letter sent to Bloomberg contained ricin preliminary tests test shows, by Richard Esposito, NBC News. And it reads as follows. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg was sent an anonymous, threatening letter that preliminary tests indicated contained the presence of the poison ricin, law enforcement officials told NBC News. A similar letter, which early tests indicated contained ricin, was also sent to the directors of Mayors Against Illegal Guns in Washington, D.C. Now, in both letters, the writer made threatening comments about Bloomberg's support for gun control, NYPD Deputy Commissioner for Public Information Paul Brown said. The letter to Bloomberg was opened on Sunday, and the letter in Washington was opened on Friday. So, in fact, what the headline said is exactly what the story isn't. Letter sent to New York Mayor Bloomberg and referencing support of gun control preliminarily tests positive for ricin. In other words, somebody in support of gun control sent a poison letter to Mayor Michael Bloomberg, only not. It turns out it's one of those lawful gun owners. You know, the ones whose tender and delicate feelings we have to be so, so concerned about, because they are the ones who are out there protecting freedom against government tyranny. That tyranny, that'll get you every time. And so your lawful gun owner gets him some ricin, which I suppose is, or I'm told, is fairly easily manufactured, although who'd want to try? It's terribly poisonous. And ricins up a letter and mails it to Michael Bloomberg because he's a lawful, freedom-protecting gun owner. Only now he's gone from being a lawful gun owner, we've taken the paren L, close paren, away, and now he's just another awful gun owner. See how that works? That's why whenever I write lawful gun owner, I always put paren, capital L, close paren, awful gun owner. Because the distance between lawful and awful is shorter even than the distance between L and no L. Well, it's not even Thanksgiving. But you get the idea. Three words. Three short, single syllable. Nope, one of them's got two. One, two, three, four. Four syllables. Cold Civil War. Cold Civil War. Because that's what happens in a cold civil war. Awful gun owners do things like sending poisonous assassination attempt letters. And by the way, I read you the text. I didn't read the whole thing, but I read the text of that. It was referred to as a ricin-laced letter. Preliminary tests indicating same. You notice when we're talking about awful gun owners, we can't even refer to that thing as what I just referred to it as, or at least the for-profit media cannot, because it really was. If you send a letter that's got poison in it that will kill the person who somehow ingests or inhales or is exposed to, contacted by the poison, then you are, by definition, trying to kill the person. And if you are trying to kill the person, and that person specifically, and that person holds some sort of public office, it becomes an assassination attempt. An attempt on the life of the mayor of New York. And it's been happening with more frequency. Assassination attempts. Not assassination conspiracies or assassination plans or assassination thoughts, but assassination attempts. This was designed to reach Michael Bloomberg and kill Michael Bloomberg. And see, as a liberal, as a progressive, whatever you care to call me, as a proponent of civil society, as a person who does not think that Haiti and Somalia are working models going forward for how we want our own nation to be, I take a dim view of assassination. I downright denounce it. I denounce governmental overthrow, because that's treason. In all the times that I have referenced Dim Leader or Richard B. Big Time Dick Cheney before he dicks you, or Rumfield or Kinda Sleazy Rice, goes great with Kinda Sleazy Chicken, or any of that whole filthy crowd, never, not once, have I, or to the best of my knowledge, anyone on this program suggested that assassination is an appropriate remedy. Because see, once you go down that road, it is almost impossible to come back. Because when you get yourself into a culture that has some portion of its membership endorsing and engaging in assassination, things are never the same. We've had entire discussions on this program about how America has never been the same since November the 22nd, 1963. And we know what the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and of Dr. King did to this country. And we're still not over it. We're still not okay. This, by the way, I think, the 29th day of May, is John F. Kennedy's birthday. Just thought I'd throw that in there. But you wonder what it would take to get the for-profit media off of its collective duffs to address the fact that people sending these letters are assassins. Only because they are. And if it was one of those awful gun owners, it's about 99.99% sure that that was not a liberal or a progressive or a registered Democrat. We desperately need to understand the nature of the crisis in which we find ourselves. More and more and more, the right wing in this country and the Republican Party are at war with you. With me, with us, with decent people. And it takes myriad forms. It takes the form of rendering government ineffective. It takes the form of a radio host who tells her nationwide audience of God knows how many people to go out and punch an Obama voter in the face. And yes, it takes the form of people putting poison in letters in an attempt to assassinate other people for simply having a point of view that is different from theirs. It's a mess, I tell you. It's a mess. Lines are open, 304-658-3333 on the Skype line, Bob Kincaid Horn.
Had to check, make sure I'm signed into Skype. I am Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. You can also reach the program via Twitter, at Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, and on Facebook, Bob Kincaid. Try to keep it fairly simple here. Let us go to the phones. Oh, by the way, I just want to mention this. Last week, I was prescribed, as a result of Cheap Blood Work Tuesday, and I went to the doctor's office, and I was very, very frustrated, because I get very frustrated when I go to the doctor's office, because, well, you know, health care. And my blood pressure was just making my hair stand on end, and I tried repeatedly to explain to the little to the young practitioner that my blood pressure remains fairly tolerable. But she said, no, 150 over 110 is bad, and I'm going to double your medication. Now, it's no big secret, the medication that I take for blood pressure is called lisinopril. It's an ACE inhibitor. And for about 20 years, I've been on a dose that's 5 milligrams, which is about as tiny as you can go and still be taking the stuff. And so she doubled it to 10. And I've been trying to get used to it since about Saturday. And I don't like it at all. I feel woozy and stupid. Oh, hey, Bob, that's any given day. No, this is different. I feel woozy and stupid and lightheaded. And if for some reason I need to bring the program to a close, it's no crisis and no disaster or anything, but it just means that this stuff is making me a little too stupid to remain upright, and that I probably need to go and lie down and, or I don't know, go out back to the salt block I've got out there for the deer and get a few licks of my own or something. And by the way, thank you. Thank you very much, Janie, for jumping in on Waggy's challenge, which was his response to Darlene's challenge. We are now, I'm proud to say, only $60 away from meeting Waggy's challenge, and only $100 total away from meeting tonight's individual fundraising goal. So thank you very much, and anybody else who wants to jump in and help Janie out and help Kate out from last night meeting Waggy's challenge, you are much appreciated indeed. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Well, hey, Tracy.
You know, I'm still thinking about the whole food stamp and the dog with the bone situation, because yesterday I had the distinct pleasure of going to see August Wilson play Joe Turner's Come and Gone, and they had a roundtable discussion with the actors in the play, who happened to be David Keith and Glenn Turman, which was very, very exciting. But the week before that, I saw the Scottsboro Boys. And yeah, I know you know the story behind that. And I was just thinking about that whole thing about, you know, the people who, for whatever, because by virtue of the fact that they are black or whatever, people of color, being accused of some heinous crime that they did not do. And, as you know, because of the jury of their peers, found them guilty. And then as a result, you know, now they can't get food. And it just, it is one of those head-scratching moments for me, because, again, I don't understand how people are allowed, how we have come into this point in this country where people are being punished for being hungry. And people are being denied food, or the possibility of being able to get food is just, again, one of those things. I'm like, really, guys? Really?
But, yeah, no
yeah,
kidding.
You know, I mean, you know, because, I mean, you do know who discussed about the Scottsboro Boys, right?
Oh, very much so, yes.
And because when I went to go see it, well, when I got the tickets for it, and I'm sitting there, well, standing at the ticket, at the box office going, how are they going to make this into a musical? Because I'm like, okay, so it's 9 young men being accused of rape by 2 white women who didn't want to go to jail. And just because 2 white, you know, two white women in the South said nine black guys raped them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that, you know, there you go. And, you know, even though one recanted, they still, you know, were found guilty.
Well, at that point in time, in a place like Alabama, Stan, they had to be guilty of something. You know, that was the operative mindset.
Well, obviously, they had to be guilty of something, for God's sake.
Well, he's guilty of being black, for starters.
You're guilty of being black, for starters.
It's called BWB, breathing while or being while black.
Yeah, you know, and so as I'm sitting here, as I'm sitting in a theater watching the musical unfold, and I'm like, okay, so I see how they can make this into a musical and poke fun at the powers that be. But then again, you go, how scary and sad that, you know, okay, of course, the laws that would affect, this law that would be coming into effect about not having, you know, a felony, if you have a felony, would not affect these men because, of course, they are, you know, long gone. But then you think about the ones that were, I don't know, in the 60s and the 50s. But these people are still alive and more than likely raising grandchildren or what have you and having to maybe get assistance. And because somebody, you know, a jury of their peers found them guilty and was it? You know, because remember, I'm not the student of American history that you are. When was it the first, or if you even know this, as far as, you know, a black person being, you know, having to go to court about some kind of felony or whatnot, when was the first time that they were actually had a jury of their peer? What decade are we talking about?
That court decision, I think, is the 60s or 70s, where somebody where the Supreme Court finally took notice that letting 12 white men judge, you know, one criminal defendant.
One of those guys.
Yeah, it is not that long ago. Of course, you must also take into account that it was rather of a rarity to see an African-American criminal defendant actually get a day in court, whether it was a kangaroo court and a trumped-up charge or not.
All right.
Because that was usually remedied by night riders and ropes and trees.
And trees. You know, you got that little thing called strange fruit.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so it was just one of those things where, you know, like you said, a jury of your peers. So we're talking the 60s and the 70s, Bob. So I was born in 1966. So we're talking my mom, who was born in 1949. So supposedly what would happen if she got convicted of a felony? And by the way, now she lives down south. Not that she would ever be convicted of a felony, but supposedly she had. Because she had the misfortune, or not so much the misfortune, but because she decided to, you know, march in a civil rights demonstration and got thrown in jail as such. So with that fluidity of violence, you know, what they consider being violent, would she be subject to no longer being allowed to get processed because of something that she was, you know, I don't know, setting up for her civil rights, but, you know, in a peaceful demonstration, but she just decided to defend herself because, I don't know, most people don't like being, you know, sprayed with water hoses and being, you know, attacked by dogs. I don't know, how do you feel about that, Bob?
Do you really need to ask?
Is that something that you, you know, I don't think that's a picnic, you know, a picnic in the park.
No. Not by any stretch of the imagination, no.
Not by any shape, form, you know, fortunately.
And see, when we talk about, well, that story from last night about David Vitter and the, you know, and the useless eaters, it has to be remembered that he represents a state that has convicted God only knows how many people of color unjustly. And so it is very possible that there would be a head of household out there who has been subjected to a horribly unjust criminal process, found guilty, convicted and sentenced, and is now apparently going to be forever banned from food stamps, regardless of the degree of rehabilitation, or the fact that he didn't even need to be rehabilitated in the first place because the whole case was dummied up, was a dummied up mess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's real. I remember when the Supreme Court of Texas upheld the conviction of a man who said he should not have been convicted because his court-appointed lawyer slept through the trial. And the Supreme Court of Texas said, well, no, just because your lawyer's asleep, it don't mean he's ineffective.
But he's not paying attention.
He might have been meditating.
You know, why should you worry about if you're a court-appointed, you know, what I call public pretender, is not on the ball. You were duly represented.
Right. It's kind of like something that, was it Obama or Eric Holder said, due process means the process that you are due.
Exactly.
Right.
So I am due these things. So it's just, again, like you said, up until the 60s or the 70s, you would not, as a black person or even a woman, when was, you know, okay, we might have got you a couple of black men on the jury. But were there any black women on the jury?
Oh, yeah, that's an entirely separate topic.
That's a whole entirely separate topic. So when you say jury...
I mean, it took a Supreme Court decision to declare that a prosecutor... Do you know how the jury process works?
Yeah, I've gotten out of jury duty of several
times. Yeah, so you start out with this big pool of jurors.
Yes.
And the big pool of jurors are queried as to what they think and what they believe and what they know about the case and don't know about the case. And that whole process is called voir dire. And it took a Supreme Court decision of the United States to declare that a prosecutor who simply struck black people off of jury panels for being black people was wrong.
Yeah. You mean that's not okay?
Right. You know, you can imagine that prosecutor going, what? What do you mean it ain't all right?
It ain't all right. What? I mean, and these are the things, like, when you...
Trying to get a conviction here, damn it.
You know, I want this boy to find. You know? So, when you hear about stuff like this, and then you go back to the whole food stamp, you know, your basic, you know, the pursuit of happiness, okay? So how can I pursue happiness if I'm hungry?
Yeah, see.
How can
well,
I?
Well, now, if you're hungry, being as how food and shelter are way up there at the top of the Maslowian hierarchy of needs, if you're hungry, the pursuit of happiness is by default or by definition over.
Over. How can I pursue happiness if I have nowhere to lay my head at night?
Yeah. The right wing would tell you it only says pursuit of happiness, and of course it's in the Declaration of Independence, which is not the law of the land.
Right.
The Constitution is. But they tell you that the pursuit of happiness, that's just the pursuit. It doesn't mean you get there.
It doesn't mean you get there, but can I at least get the chance to pursue it? Can I at least have food in my stomach and an education and a place to lay my head so I can have the means to pursue the happiness? Doesn't mean, like you said, doesn't mean I'm going to necessarily get there.
You liberal. You knee-jerk.
You knee-jerk liberal.
Bleeding heart.
Bleeding heart, Connie.
Yeah.
You know, because I have this thing about, you know, I don't know, my fair share and... Well, shoot, I'm still waiting for my, I know a few people still waiting for a 40 acres and a mule.
Yeah, don't be going out and buying the seed yet. Besides,
yeah.
You'll have to buy it from Monsanto anyway, and who wants to grow that?
If you buy Monsanto, it would be some kind of Franken wheat.
Yeah, see, and I was, speaking of Monsanto, I was totally suckered last night. The hook was out there, it's dangling in the water. I swam up,
okay,
and I bought it, and I swallowed it all the way down to my gizzard.
What did you do?
Well, that's the problem. The problem, Tracy, is that the distance between parody, satire, and reality has become so damn blurred.
I need another prescription, a pair of prescription glasses, just to see it again.
Right. So, that's Michelle Bachman leaving. That's for another day. But no, this story, and you know, it wasn't whether I wanted it to be true or didn't want it to be true. It just seemed real enough to
be true.
Yeah. Beth sent this along from down in Texas. And I was, you know, I think it was Beth. Let's see, where'd it go? Oh, there it is. It comes from a website called IntelliHub, which doesn't sound like The Onion.
Right.
Okay, here's the headline. Monsanto cucumbers cause genital baldness immediately banned in Nova Scotia. Now wait, we're not even at the good part. And I blew right through it without seeing the paren under the dateline that said this article is satire. Now tell me, now just tell me, would you, because I need to know if I'm just gullible. Knowing what we know about Monsanto and about Frankenfoods and about splicing goat stomach genes into potatoes and shit like that, if you read the following, Tracy, would you say, well, of course? A 6-month study by AgriSearch, an on-campus research arm of Dalhousie University, hell, it's Canada, there may be a Dalhousie University, has shown that genetically modified cucumbers grown under license to Monsanto Inc. result in serious side effects, including total groin hair loss and chafing in sensitive areas, leading to the immediate and total ban of sales of all that company's crop and subsequent dill pickles.
Okay.
I bought.
Being the sick bitch that I am.
The tracking study of 643 men and women in Nova Scotia came about after reports began to surface about bald field mice and the bald feral cats that ate them being discovered by farmers on acreages growing the new crop. The bald wild animals raised a huge flag, and we immediately obtained subpoenas for the medical records of all 600-plus adults who took part in focus groups and taste tests of the cucumbers by Monsanto in Canada, said Dr. Nancy Walker, director of public health research at Dalhousie. Fully 3/4 of the people who ate these cukes had their crotch area hair fall out. This is not a joking matter at all. These people now have hairless hinies. One of these days, Tracy, that's not going to be a parody story. That's not going to be satire.
No.
One of these days, Monsanto's going to put something out there on the market that makes a baby's arm grow out of your head.
Okay. On that note, I'm going to go because I have a testimony.
I think I hurt you. I feel like such a maroon. It's such an absolute.
But anyway, I gotta go because I gotta listen to this.
Hey, you've got a fare. Good night, Tracy. Good afternoon, Tracy. Bye now. I just worry sometimes. I want Tracy out there safe on the I-5 or whatever it is that runs between that highway to LAX and into the city. Yes, that would be a genitally modified orgasm. Lottie with a serious point. Actually, one of these days Monsanto will put something out that makes men impotent, then watch the sparks fly. Evening, Lottie. Onward. Lines open if you want to jump in. 304-658-3333.
keeping it together as best I can with the, you know, this low blood pressure BS. Let's roll on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy. What's happening, man?
Hey, I brought this up to the wall last night. Some people probably heard it, but in our ongoing never-ending dig to Iraq, on Memorial Day, 60 people were killed by bombers.
We brought him freedom.
Well, he said that he heard the story, and then it sounded like there were 7 different bombs in different parts of whatever city it was set off to go off and create mass destruction, which they did.
Yeah, you know, I hate to say anything nice about Pappy Bush, you know, George H.W. Bush, but he did say that maybe invading Iraq and removing Saddam Hussein from power wouldn't be the best idea in the world because it would create a power vacuum, and then people would start bombing each other, and everything would just go to hell in a handcart. Which is what happened.
Yeah, and it's
and that's what happens when you let a son who has daddy issues have the job that daddy once had. Yeah, I'm better than you, daddy. See here, look here. Let's go mano a mano, old man. Right.
Right, and of course this is all done in the name of freedom, and they're going to get them.
Yeah.
When we all know it really had to do with oil and resources and things like that, and I mean, if nothing else said it, how about the 2 times we've invaded there, and as the Iraqis fled, they blew up all the oil rigs as they were leaving.
Yeah.
They weren't dumb. They knew why we were there. It wasn't so much Saddam as it was the resources or the control of them. Who knows? And this is essentially now ethnic cleansing on a grand scale of the Sunnis against the Shias because they had control for so long. It's the same thing that's going on in Libya, sort of, and then what's the other country that I hear so much about right now? I can't think of the name.
Syria?
Yeah, Syria, yes. Same exact idea. That's Sunni Shia there, too.
Well, it's pretty much throughout that region. The primary difference being that, you know, one of the reasons that Iran is the way Iran is, and I'm not going any deeper than that, is because they actually have a Shia majority, and the Shia majority are running the show. Whereas there's a Shia majority in Iraq, and they're not running the show. And the same in Syria. There's a lot of Shia out there. A lot of Sunni too, but they tend to be outnumbered.
Right.
It's a great big Islamic game of sneeches. You remember
right.
Sneeches, right? With stars upon the R's and the ones with no stars upon the R's. Star-bellied sneeches.
Yeah, I remember Dr. Seuss.
Yeah. A very, very instructive little tale, that. But, you know, if you go back, for instance, to the interview with Dr. Jeremy Suri out of Austin that was, a few weeks back on one of the Prism chats. If you go back and look at that, what you'll find is that he talks about the United States not training diplomats very well, and that this is what we get when we don't understand the rest of the world. Yeah, we'll just go over there and bring them freedom, and then they'll have Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Jesus, you know. I mean, did you read the story about how the sad people who have to live in the Gaza Strip can at least now get Kentucky Fried Chicken? They order it from Egypt, and it comes through a tunnel by delivery. They have to pay a little extra delivery fee, but you know, they can't have freedom, they can't have human rights, but they can have corporate chicken.
Well, yeah, that's us reaching out of our corporate hand in being greedy again. I mean, there's KFC really is owned by PepsiCo on a grand scale. So is Pizza Hut.
Well, no, actually, they're owned by Yum Brands. Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, KFC, Long John Silver's, yada, yada, yada. Yum Brands. And there's even an exclamation point with the yum. And then I think there is a tie into PepsiCo there as well.
Yeah, I'd say definitely. I worked for Pepsi for 7 years, so there was a tie in there of some sort. There's no words to express my anger in us reaching out our imperious little arms wherever we go and leaving horror in our wake. And we walk away and say, oh, well, we trained their defense forces. They can handle it. And we knew it was going to happen because it happened while we were training them. But at the same point, we walk away. We took away the stabilizing power in the whole Mideast in taking away Saddam, not just in Iraq. Yes, he was a bad guy and he did horrible things. But he was the...
Yeah, so was George W. Bush, a bad guy who did horrible things. But
yeah, yes, I give him that. But he really... not Osama, but Saddam really was the yin and the yang to Iran and to Osama bin Laden. He didn't like them anymore than he liked him because he was so it's my way or the highway. He didn't want to work with them. They were totally separate minds and all around. Angry. That's all I can say right now.
Right. And this gets better how?
And it doesn't get better because we keep hearing, well, this will eventually end, but every couple of weeks, there's a horrible story of a kid here shooting someone. There's a story of someone over there blowing up a crowd because Muhammad told them to or something like that.
Yeah, people.
Even though that's a perversion of the Bible, the Quran, as much as Bible thumpers down here corrupt our Bible.
Mercy sakes. Yeah.
Well, again, I don't have answers. I just have just comment. That's all.
Yeah. I know.
But hopefully it feels better, Bob, and I'll let you go. And hopefully this didn't stir your stomach too much.
No, I'll make it through. But you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, couple this up with Bomber John going to visit the Syrians, and I guess the question I'm asking is, are we incapable of learning, or do we simply refuse to? Because see, what we need—I guess you know me—I'm one of those big picture guys, Jeremy. And you know, I think back to the fact that, and we can go all the way to World War I, and the House of Hashemi agreed to help the Allies, you know, the British, the French, in ousting the Turks because the Turk from the Arabian Peninsula, because the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, what was it called, the Grand Porte, were allied with the Germans. Mistake on their part. And so they launched the guerrilla. They mounted the guerrilla war that was made famous by T. E. Lawrence, on the premise that they would have freedom once the Turks were defeated. The English and the French, for the most part, screwed them. Okay, so the Royal House of Hashemi, though, they wind up with the throne in Iraq, they wind up with the throne in Jordan, and they wind up with a throne in Saudi Arabia, in what was then the Arabian Peninsula. The word Saudi Arabia, Jeremy, comes from the fact that in 1925... at which time American oil companies had decided they wanted some of that tasty, juicy money that was flowing out of the sands there, the United States backed a coup by the Royal House of Ibn Saud in the mid-1920s to topple the Hashemite control of the Arabian Peninsula because the Hashemites were indebted to the English, which meant that the English controlled the Saudi oil. So that's, I think that's the origins, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, of Aramco, the Arab American Oil Company. And so you wait about 25 more years, and lo and behold, there we are in Iraq overturning Mohammad Mossadegh, democratically elected prime minister of Iran, because he wanted to nationalize the oil that belonged to Iran and sort of, take a little bit bigger cut and boot the British out of Iran. So we overturned the democratically elected leader of Iran and installed a two-bit thug named Reza Pahlavi, and we called him the Shah. And so my question is, knowing that we are the authors of a lot of these problems, Jeremy.
Right.
Knowing these things, Are we dumb or stupid? Are we ignorant or stupid? Ignorance can be cured with education and a desire to learn. But as I've seen on that on the bumper sticker a number of times, you can't fix stupid.
Stupidity is fatal, and I think we're stupid. I don't think we're ignorant. I think we know quite well what we do at this point. And I think as a whole, a large portion of the population chooses to turn their eyes and look away from it, say, not my house, not my backyard, not my country, not my problem.
Bingo. But
they do lose their kids, their uncles, their fathers, sometimes their mothers, their aunts, in horrific aftershocks from these things that have happened. It's a willing plea.
And I guess the next question is, for instance, if you go out and, like, torch up some meth and do something stupid, or drink a half a gallon of rot gut liquor and do something stupid, well, you can argue that your use of the substance is what has made you stupid. So the next question for me is, what has made America, where foreign policy is concerned, stupid? And I have a ready answer if you'd like it.
Sure.
Capitalism.
Yes.
Avarice. Greed. The desire for money that overreaches and overarches every noble principle that might be ensconced in some little corner of our national consciousness. Greed is what makes America stupid. It's what led to the coup in the Arabian Peninsula. It is what led to the coup in Iran, and frankly, it's what led to Iraq. Yeah, we're going to... Remember that? Remember that, Jeremy? The Iraq war will pay for itself with oil revenues? Remember that? Yeah, that didn't happen.
No, it didn't. That was one of those things they said that the collective mind tends to forget, that was said because it wasn't repeated enough to beat the... story in the people like the Bush love to do.
Right, and it wasn't repeated with nearly the frequency that that you know, Saddam did 9/11 to us.
Yeah, and you know, we heard that for year upon year upon year, and God bless her heart for this. Randy Rhodes went out, and one of her people went out and took an excerpt from Bush at a press conference 3 or 4 years removed from saying that. And he's quietly saying, but you didn't hear it in much mass media play, but he says, we have no evidence that Saddam Hussein had any part of 9/11 or weapons of mass destruction. Actually, we've already been there bombing the piss out of them for 6 years.
There you go.
And that gets played in their intro. So, I mean, it's done over and over again, but again, that doesn't get as many ears as we'd like to think it would. And even if it did, people would hear it and say it's a lie and choose not to want to believe it because they don't want to know the ugly truth.
Right, and so, you know, we've let the stupid do us tremendous harm in the rest of the world, and now the chickens are coming home to roost. And I'm not talking about 9/11. I'm talking about the tar sands. We are gonna let the same thing that brought on our stupidity elsewhere be our ruination at home, Jerry.
Yeah, the tar sands is a horrible thing, and like... so many studies have shown if there's one slip of it, it's going to create chaos.
Yeah, and you know...
One slip in...
With the caveat that I said earlier that I would never urge assassination or bodily violence, it is hard to overcome that urge to, you know, to strap an ExxonMobil CEO into a chair and tell him to start drinking tar sands oil until he's had enough and understands that water is more important than oil.
Did you see, now that you're speaking, forcing someone to drink something, did you ever see the documentary Gasland or whatever it was?
Oh, yeah, Josh Fox. Yeah, he's working on a second one right now.
In that scene where the oil exec comes in the house and there's nothing wrong with his water, and the farmer, the homeowner, pours a cup and says, here, have a cup. And the guy's like, oh, no, we got bottled water here for you. We don't need to be tasting it. Because he knew damn well what was in that water.
And see, that's we've known this kind of stuff for years here in Appalachia, Jeremy, because we've asked coal company executives who say, you know, the water coming off our mountaintop removal sites is more pure than even your tap water is. So we hand them a glass and say, drink up, bub. No, thank you. I ain't thirsty. Now, never mind the fact that... You know, we drink it, we bathe in it. I think about the woman who was so meticulous in making sure that her children brushed their teeth every night, and she was doing it with their well water, and they brushed their teeth until their teeth dissolved in their heads. And then within that same time frame, Diane Sawyer of the for-profit media, ABC at the time or something, comes down here and does an expose on children's tephus, hillbilly children's tephuses in Appalachia, and she blames it on, I kid you not, I remember the night well, I about had a purple polka-dotted blue scream and hissy. If I was Kate, I would have just thrown my dress over my head and gone running around the room. That's like Kate described. Because I remember when Diane Sawyer attributed children with their teeth rotting out of their head to, and I kid you not, you can look it up, Mountain Dew mouth. Because they found some young idiot who was putting Mountain Dew in her baby's bottle and letting the baby go sucking madly away on Mountain Dew. Well, obviously, this is the case of Mountain Dew mouth.
Yeah, ironically enough that you mentioned baby bottle problems, my mother was a dental hygienist for the state of Vermont for 40 years. So I've heard all about the baby bottle things, and I'm going to go on a limb here and guess that there's probably a fair number of kooks in West Virginia, as there are here in Vermont, that swear to Christ that fluoride is a government program to basically brainwash you, and that it causes so many diseases, and it's just there so you don't question anything, and it's a mind-controlled drug.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are people here who say things, for instance, like, well, y'all, them tree huggers is all worried about mountaintop removal. But what about all them people got them straight pipes coming out of their plumbing, putting their poo in the creeks? Let's quit pooing in the creek, and then we can worry about the coal industry.
Exactly.
Not kidding. By the way, a note just came. from Dr. John with the subject line "Gentle pushback, maybe." And Dr. John says, I think you just said or implied capitalism makes you stupid. I did. And Dr. John has a very, very good point. He says, I would dispute slightly. Capitalism, and this is the God's honest and unfly-blown truth, Jeremy. Capitalism elevates narrow self-interest into a virtue. That's so concise and so perfect. Capitalism elevates narrow self-interest into a virtue. That's not stupidity, it's malevolent and self-destructive. Much worse than stupidity, but there are alternatives. And Dr. John just says, another time. And we have to find those alternatives. If they're out there, I want to know about them. I want to learn about them. But, yeah, it elevates narrow self-interest into a virtue. It's malevolent and self-destructive. And so our malevolence and destructive tendencies that we put on display in places like the Arabian Peninsula, in Iran, good Lord, Guatemala, Honduras, Vietnam, on and on, Iraq, Afghanistan, maybe Syria soon, Jesus. We are now going to project onto ourselves. And the malevolence and the self-destruction won't be happening in some far-flung corner of the globe. It'll be happening on Main Street, Anytown, USA. It's already happened. It's already happened, for instance, in Arkansas.
Yeah, definitely. I'll leave you with a slight funny thing that I saw, and it's funny to me. It'll probably be funny to a lot of the Horn listeners, too. There's a show on NBC called Revolution. Basically, there's no power left in the world. They're trying to get it turned back on. And in last week's episode, which is a cliffhanger until this week's, which will be at the end of the season, they found an elevator shaft which goes down into a bunker, essentially. And it's well-fortified with all sorts of top-secret weapons and stuff. And they get down there, and the bad guy asks one of the main guys, what is this place? And this was definitely a rub at someone. And the main character in the show looked at him and said, it was Dick Cheney's bunker when he was vice president.
Ooh.
And I got the best chuckle. I had to rewind 300 to make sure they said it, but it definitely said it was Vice President Dick Cheney's when he was vice president, his fallback. It was his secret hideout in case the world went to hell.
It was his spider hole.
Especially in, Right, and essentially in this tower, you could find anyone on Earth and kill them from that tower.
Jesus.
So it was a spider hole. I mean, it was probably a little bit fiction, but a little bit truth rubbed into it. So I got a good chuckle that they did do that on NBC.
Very nice. Very nice indeed. Jeremy, have yourself a wonderful evening.
You too.
You've helped take us to the halfway mark of the show, and I really appreciate it. That's our buddy Jeremy calling from Vermont. Lines open, 304-658-3333. This is After All Conversation Radio, and that was a lovely conversation with Jeremy. This from Randy in PA. Subject line, let the weapons flow, destabilize the Middle East, enrich the CEO. Randy says, the U.S. produces two main products. One, the world's deadliest weapons. Two, fraudulent Wall Street securities. Amen. And by the way, Greg Palast says that the second Iraq war's purpose was to limit Iraqi oil. Saddam was going to pump more oil than OPEC wanted, which would have driven the price of oil down. Yeah, and there's also the fact that he was going to go to a non-dollar bourse. He was going to break away from the dollar as the primary trade currency for his oil. And yeah, thanks for the reminder and the correction, Jim. The Ottoman Empire was referred to as the Sublime Porte, also as the sick man of Europe. I really like that thought, that the way Dr. John expressed that. Capitalism elevates narrow self-interest into a virtue. That's not stupidity. It's malevolent and self-destructive. Sometimes we give away toasters on the program, not for funny things, but for profound ones, and that's toaster-worthy. This in from Jan, going back to my conversation with Tracy, all about the whole food stamp story from last night. No food stamps or help to feed me and my family. What should I do? Well, if I do not have a job, all that's left is stealing and maybe killing in the process. What do these stupid people expect to happen? Well, I can offer you my theory on that, Jan. They expect the people who do that to be incarcerated. They expect the incarceration to take place in for-profit prisons, and then they expect to get a dividend check from the for-profit prison company of America on their next quarterly earnings report. You can't run prisons for profit without people to put in the beds. Just a thought. Granny B. Hey, Brother Bob. Granny B from Tennessee. Just love your prayer meeting hymnal. Brought back good memories. I saw the Amazing Rhythm Aces back in the 70s. Duh, but it was with my husband, Person. Guess that ruins my sinning story, and thus will not have to ask Reverend Rat or Reverend Pat for any advice. Could give him a little advice, but doubt he would take it. Got the word Bobbit word in it. How about closing with In Spite of Ourselves? John Prine and Iris DeMent, perfect for altar call. Love you and the Horn Gang. We'll try to send a few bucks in the soon near future, but as with you, can't keep up with the insert expletives here, medical bills. Lots of expletives, Granny B. If not too personal, what county in Alabama did you grow up in? Lauderdale. Not too personal at all. Lauderdale. Signed, your fan, Granny T in Tennessee, Madison County, Jackson, Pinson Mounds, etc., in case you don't recall our conversation from long ago, but I do. Signing off to hear all about genital baldness with you and Tracy has always been one of my major interests. Oh, I was so suckered. But you know, there are psychological ramifications. That I was willing to believe that. You know, Fields' three commandments. You can't cheat an honest man, never give a sucker an even break, and don't smarten up a chump. Well, I guess I was dishonest in my approach to that story because I was willing to believe it true because I have such a very, very low opinion of Monsanto.
they probably will produce a cucumber that causes genital baldness someday. And they'll tell us it's good for us. And they'll ask us why we don't want to eat it. And they'll say, but it's good for business. And they'll sue some poor schmuck who's growing non-genitally balding cucumbers to force him to sell his land so that they can grow genitally balding cucumbers on his land. Jesus. I gotta look up this song for Granny T. There it is. Alright. I hope we get to it, Granny T. We're all queued up now. Okay, so it is Prayer Meeting Wednesday, and we got more Prayer Meeting Wednesday stories. Let us go, for instance, to Alabamistan. Remember that scientific report that said inside of a generation, a quarter of the Earth's population or more will be without a secure water supply. We have wars breaking out. We have violence and hunger and death and disease. But down in, I reckon, Helena, who knew, Alabamistan, there's a preacher who knows what the real problem is. Gay Boy Scouts. We take you now to WBRC Fox 6 out of Birmingham, Alabama. As quickly as the godforsaken commercial for, no, really, Alabama Power, burner of coal, is over with. I'm not even going to pop this up because I'd start cursing and screaming, and nobody wants to hear that.
I'm flat.
All right. Goodbye. Goodbye, little freak. Here we go.
Parents of Boy Scouts should remove their...
Now, hold on just a darn minute. Well, this buffering makes me crazy. Here we go.
Bath remodeling?
Oh, for God's sakes. If I had a staff, we'd just lay all these tracks down as tracks way before the show started. But... Come on, Cletus Fuller Noy. We'll be done with this in a minute. I really want you to hear the story. And it comes from last night's WBRC Fox 6 News. I remember when WBRC was ABC.
Boy Scouts should remove their children from the organization.
That's the message from one Atlanta area pastor. And some local churches are keeping the Scouts from meeting at their churches. Fox 6 News reporter Ariel Clay is in the newsroom tonight to explain why.
Well, Beth and Scott, evangelical church leaders are not happy about the Boy Scouts' decision to allow openly gay members in their organization. And I got a chance to speak with a pastor from the First Baptist Church of Helena about why the Scouts are no longer welcome at his church.
It's hard for us.
Goddess of irony, always on the job. First words out of his mouth, the preacher talking about homosexuality and gay folks being allowed to be Boy Scouts. And he says, what? It's hard for us. Well, you are a man of God, so I imagine it probably is hard for you when you go to talking about little boys, Pastor Thumbbutt.
On a personal level, to say to a troop of young boys who've done nothing wrong, and to the leaders who've done nothing wrong in Helena, you're not welcome to be here anymore.
But that's exactly what First Baptist Church of Helena pastor Greg Walker says he must do.
Yeah, I hate it for the kids. I didn't make the decision. Boy Scouts of America made that decision.
A decision to change one of their policies and begin to allow openly gay members to join the Boy Scouts. And Walker says the change has forced him to make a decision of his own. The pastor will no longer allow Helena's troop number two to meet at his church.
Now, I don't feel that I can allow a group to openly support a sinful lifestyle while under the umbrella of First Baptist Helena.
In a written statement to Fox 6 about the decision to not allow troops in certain churches, the Greater Alabama Council Boy Scouts said, quote, "Early on in this process, we decided to make a very strong commitment that if something like this did come up, we would continue to support our units in finding and having somewhere to meet," end quote. Walker says he feels as if the boys of Troop 2 are ultimately the ones who lose in this situation, but he says that will not stop him from keeping them out.
I hate that this had to happen. I really do.
You can tell how much he hates it, can't you? Don't you love the peace that passeth all understanding and flows from Christ Jesus through his loving followers? I didn't do this. Boy Scouts of America did this. No. The Boy Scouts of America simply said that decided to be an inclusive group that would no longer enshrine bigotry and intolerance within its ranks. What Pastor Greg Walker did was his decision. But he's such a filthy, stinking, rotten, bigoted, racist, well, probably homophobic Christian that he can't even own his own decision. I didn't make the decision. Boy Scouts of America did. You might recall last week sometime when the story broke that Brian Fisher of the American Family Association Radio in Tupelo, Mississippi declared that it's no longer the Boy Scouts of America but the Boy Sodomizers of America. They spend an awful lot of time thinking about that, don't they? He went on, Pastor Walker did, servant of Christ. I warned scouting executives that this would happen, and they supposedly realized it would happen, but they thought they would gain more. He warned them. He warned them, like he's some sort of Old Testament prophet. I warned them. I assured them that if your goal is to minister to the largest number of youth, those were their words, then changing this is going to be a detriment to your goal. Because if you allow them homosexual boys in, next thing you know, they won't be learning woodcraft no more, and they'll be walking, they'll be sashaying through the woods in a goddamn tutu. Oh, that was Southern Baptist Convention President Frank Page. What happened to Southern Baptist Convention President Dick Land? That was his name, Dick Land. Too much to hope that he's gone to his long home, his just reward. This is sickening. I thought there was no I in Jesus. I can't allow a group to openly support a sinful lifestyle under the umbrella of First Baptist Helena. A sinful lifestyle. He's just made it clear that he holds that gay people cannot go to heaven with him. Anybody want to share a heaven with Pastor Greg Walker? Because I'm taking a pass. him and Jerry Falwell sitting up there plucking church in the Wildwood on their little little harps and little Hosanna and harps. Now, see, I did not threaten violence against the man. I only noted that I hope he gets hit by a bus. Sweet Jesus. What a puke. It's hard on a personal level to say to a troop of young boys who've done nothing wrong and to the leaders, you're not welcome here. Can somebody explain to me how sexuality even factors in to what the Boy Scouts of America do or don't do? Is there a gay way to tie an effing knot? Is there a gay way to build a campfire? Is there a gay way? Well, next thing you know, they'll have gay merit badges and interior design merit badges and Broadway show musical merit badges, and then where will we be? Honest to Pete, how much sexuality does a Cub Scout have? Now, granted, when you get up around 12, 13, 14 years old, there's some sexuality involved. Because it's developing, because they're young humans. But you see, they really do think that. They think that there's something that the gays are going to make the Boy Scouts all gay when there's been gay Boy Scouts for umpty bajillion years, for as long as there's been Scouts. It's just a question of whether or not they get to be who they are instead of stomped near to death for it. Yeah, see? Me too, Lottie. Says Lottie in the chat room. I wonder if there will be a gay scouting manual. That gots to be, because, I mean, that's where you're going to put the gay agenda. They're going to put the gay agenda, right? Because they got one of those. Hey, welcome to the program.
Just a question.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm wrong here, but I have heard that even the founder of the Boy Scouts, Lord Baden Powell, was himself gay.
I don't know that to be a fact, but it would not surprise me in the least.
I haven't looked it up or anything like that, but I've heard that, and because I would go to another site, but I'd lose, you know, your program. But nonetheless, so that's what I've heard.
Yeah, Lottie telling me in the chat room, yes, he was, Bob. So, yes, he was, Jim.
Okay, I heard that, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it didn't hurt the Boy Scouts back then in turn of the century when it was established, I don't think. I don't think it still hurt them now to have gay members of Scout troops. I mean, they were, as you said before, there have been a lot of gay scouts. And, you know, hey, that's just the way it is, the way it was, that people just don't want to realize it.
I think, among others, George Takei, who played Sulu on Star Trek, was an Eagle Scout.
Yeah. Were you a Boy Scout?
No, I was not.
Yeah, I was.
I was too caught up in DMLA.
Well, I was in that too, but I was a Boy Scout and got up to, let's see, Star or Life, I can't remember which. It was right below Eagle. And then I kind of lost interest in it, you know.
Well, Eagle is a hard thing to achieve.
Yeah, it is, and I had other things that were making demands on my time, but I enjoyed my scouting, camporees and stuff like that, and there wasn't any sex involved in that. I mean, you know, we were busy learning how to tie
right, clothes, and that you just
a clove hitch or, you know, or
Sheepshank or...
Yeah, right. They're basically Navy knots and stuff like that, or square knots, whatever. You know, I mean, there are a lot of things in the merit badge system. Promoted a lot of good things. I mean, back when I was a Boy Scout, you got a merit badge for cooking.
Sure. It's still there.
And that's a...
But you just really sort of alighted on the ultimate reality of this, Jim. And it is the fact that this says ever so much. These responses like this fine, upstanding Christian pastor in Alabama says ever so much more about him and his religion and what he thinks being gay means than it does about any gay person who might wind up in scouting openly.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, you know, what, if you're a gay scout, do you have to, I don't know, wear leather and chaps or something with your little scout uniform? Or?
I don't think so.
Yeah, me either. But in the mind of Pastor Greg Walker, well, I'm reminded of that woman in Selmer, Tennessee, who was married to the Church of Christ pastor some several years back, and just got the family 12-gauge one day and blew a basketball-sized hole in his back with it, and then took the children and went to the beach. And when they put her on trial, she put up a defense of, I guess, what, necessity or self-defense, and at the trial, they admitted into evidence and showed the jury the wig and hooker heels that the upstanding minister, man of God, had to have her wear in order to be able to perform his husbandly function in their marriage bed.
Oh, he was into the kinky stuff.
They were platform. They were strappy platform sandals with like a 5-inch heel and a 3-inch platform, and you know, some really, really outlandish wig.
You know, it's just amazing to me the stuff that turns some of these people on. And I think they're so obsessed with this sexuality thing that I would hazard to make the following statement, that they're just so interested in it and they just can't wait in their own way to have some type of participation in fame. And that scares them half to death, so that's the reason they're so openly anti-gay and secret in secret. God, they just there's just accidents looking for a place to happen, and you know, they are so closeted.
Well, ordinarily the word we would use, the catch-all phrase we would use for all that is latency, right? But there is so much latency that it's not latent anymore. It's what? Patent? Overt?
Pretty much.
And I mean, not to stereotype or anything, but I'll note that since we were listening to audio of Pastor Walker, nobody could see the video. But he's sitting there in his pastoral office, by the way, in a pink polo shirt.
Oh, wow. You better watch out. Hot stuff.
Well, I mean, look, I'm pretty okay with my... No, I'm sexuality, talking about masculinity, whatever.
I'm talking about
pink.
Yeah.
Pink looks good on me. So I don't give a damn. I've got pink shirts. I don't think twice about it. But for somebody who sits around obsessing day in and day out about gayness,
yeah, there's something.
And you show up for an interview with the biggest TV station in the middle of the state of Alabama in a pink polo shirt. Dr. Freud just lit he lit one of those Churchill cigars, because it's going to take a while to work through that.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And, of course, Buddy Jay points out that the silver lining in Boy Scouts policy change is the decreased influence that these fundamentalist churches will have on the troops that they will no longer be sponsoring. And that's true.
Well, that is true, because I think a lot of scouts have their meetings in the fellowship halls of different churches and things of that nature. I I don't think that would happen if a troop were to meet in the fellowship hall of an Episcopal church.
Well, I was about to say the same thing. I wonder if Helena, Alabama, has an Episcopal church that might be interested in sponsoring this troop and teaching them how to hate after all the years that these Baptists have taught them that, that hate is the watchword of their loving God.
I don't think so. I mean, they need to realize one thing, that hate is not a family value. But to them, it is.
Be all and end all of their existence.
You got a point there. Definitely got a point there.
Well, Jim, you have yourself a good evening. I'm glad you chimed in on that.
Well, I just wanted to ask that question without having to punch too many keys and stuff like that. But anyway, I just thought I would do that. And, you know, that's about it. But like I say, parts of my early development, and, you know, I'm not that I turned out so great or whatever, but I mean, God knows you heard me talk about some of the crazy stuff that I've done and stuff like that. But, you know, scouting played a definite role in it, and it was very healthy and very, it was part of, you know, human growth and development.
Yeah, and it teaches about a sense of honor and a sense of courage and duty and decency and a sense of community and loyalty.
And to be prepared. So they better be prepared for a lot of crap that's coming from these other people, you know?
Yeah, it was fascinating. You know, I've mentioned before that I try to catch the Tony Bourdain new incarnation of his show on CNN on Sunday nights at 9. And
yeah, he's been going on. I mean, I just wonder how long that relationship is going to last with CNN.
I've heard the word shit. I've heard the word dick. And it's running its 9 on Sunday night, so I guess CNN just, you know, is saying we're on the cable, so, you know, bite me, FCC. But he's also taken shots at people like John King and Wolf Blitzer and that crowd. But what I was going to point out is the episode that he did in Libya, they stopped at Leptis Magna, which, you know, it's the best preserved Roman ruin anywhere in the region.
Yeah, I know.
And that was where the word dick was used, because he said, look, they knocked off all the dicks, talking about the statuary and what the Muslim purists had done.
Right.
But the thing is, they went to the amphitheater, and lo and behold, there was a Libyan Boy Scout troop. And for everything that Bourdain has been through, and he writes freely about it, you know, junkie, crackhead, on and on and on, he was able to stand there and say to those Libyan boys in English, you know, with these little fingers sticking up in the air, the scout's oath. And they repeated it back to him in Arabic. It was beautiful. It was charming.
Well, he does have a very interesting program, and I watch him from time to time when I, you know, when he's on, and he's more visible now since he's gone to CNN. I think he was, on Bravo or something like that?
Yeah, he was on the Travel Channel, and before that he was on the Food Network.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
But he had to get away from Rachel Ray. She was trying to kill him.
Oh, boy. Let me ask you one.
And Paula Deen.
As far as North African cities that belong to Rome, where was Timyad? Wasn't that another big Roman city?
I don't recognize the name.
I believe so. Timgad, Timyad. I think it was a Roman outpost, and it was big enough, if I'm not mistaken, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you know, to have basically, it was a miniature Rome.
Yeah, the same thing happened with Leptis Magna, because it was the birthplace and home of the young man who went on to become Emperor Septimus Severus.
Exactly.
And he showered a massive building program on it, and that's why its ruins are so stupendous.
Right.
And Libya being Libya, it's not all touristed up. Oh, I'd love to see it. I would absolutely love to see it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, listen, you have a good evening.
All right, you too, Jim.
Bye.
Take care. Our good buddy Jim. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John. How you doing?
Hey, John, how are you?
Oh, I'm real good. Listen, I'm thrilled. It was my first toaster, I think.
Was it really?
Yeah, I believe so, actually.
I'll
so,
be gone.
Yeah, good night.
Yeah, don't watch the mail. It's an imaginary toaster.
Oh, no, I have no doubt and would expect nothing more or nothing less.
With bagel-wide slots and and wide slots for big bread and, you know, dual mud flaps and chrome and, yeah, right.
Browning control?
Absolutely.
You can go from Elizabeth Barrett up all the way up to Robert Browning?
Precisely. Precisely.
This is the only place I could make that pun, and I think folks would get it. So, anyway.
I'm sure there's a lot of people giggling out there right now.
Excellent. I'm just glad I got to work that in. Listen, I wanted just to, I kind of wanted to talk about fracking. And basically, I'm back up in upstate New York. And, you know, I forget just how beautiful this place is, honestly. I've been down in North Carolina, and I'm a southerner by breeding, but never thought I could really come to love a place like this, which is really, it's rural, it's really kind of middle of nowhere. It's the north, it's freezing 7 months out of the year. But this is a really special place up here.
Well, you're in good company, John, because remember,
yeah.
Mr. Clemens left Missouri via Nevada and then San Francisco, and when he got to upstate New York, he said, "I'm stopping. I'm home. There's nothing better. This is the most beautiful place I've ever seen."
Well, you know what? I tell you, I've up at Elmira College, which is about an hour west of here. They've got his writing studio preserved. The house where they lived and his grave. And if you ever are in the region, man, you got to make a pilgrimage there because it is something to behold.
Well, and that's exactly what it would be. It would be a holy pilgrimage.
Yeah, yeah, it's really amazing, and I definitely, you know, understand it. It's taken me a while to adjust to that, but especially, you know, this season, spring, it's gorgeous. And where we're at right now in New York State is our governor Andrew Cuomo is supposed to make a decision on whether he's going to lift the moratorium on fracking that's been in place here in New York State, supposedly before the next election. So we're coming up with that. He's under intense pressure. There was talk that there was a quid pro quo, you know, maybe when we did the marriage equality decision last year, that, you know, maybe there was something under the table for the
right
for the frackers to get some of the Republicans online. I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, it's the kind of thing you got to worry about.
Well, it smells like American politics, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, this isn't the cleanest state of all. And, you know, I actually love listening to Dr. Bill talk about the ratification. And, you know, the New York delegates held out for a long time because, man, there was money to be made trading with Britain. You know, we didn't want to do that.
No, right, right.
Separate ties. But, well, no, it's a special place, and I'm highly concerned that, you know, that's going to disappear if we get the development up here that they're talking about maybe happening.
Well, just look at Pennsylvania to the south of you. Look at all the horror stories.
Well,
independent contractors, poorly paid, going out and dumping toxic waste from fracking operations in the middle of state lands. I remember the night that Spike told us all about that.
Yeah, game lands too, which actually pissed off the sort of hunter and naturalist groups, which seems like a constituency you wouldn't want to make angry, but they did. Yeah, it's a mess down there. I've got some, I've got some sort of personal connections to some of that, and it's really troubling. And I think the problem is where I live is an economically depressed region of the state. I mean, really everything north of the bedroom counties of New York City and Albany is depressed. You know, I mean, you know, industry left, you know, decades ago,
right.
And so the whole argument is, well, you know, we bring in fracking, it's going to create jobs, which you're familiar with.
Oh God, that makes me run rabbits.
Well, it does, but my issue is, like, it seems to me to be an end game strategy. If you follow me, like, okay. Maybe jobs are created. Maybe some people prosper, especially rural landowners, right? Maybe from leasing. But if you foul the water and the soil and the air, that's basically what we have going for us up here. This is an incredibly rich agricultural region. The whole all of New York north and west of Hudson is, you know, amazing produce, amazing wine, amazing apples, amazing water for beer and brewing. I mean, it's just so many of these little small scale.
Those little purple fingerling purple potatoes, and yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you can't get a decent apple in North Carolina. I can tell you that for sure, you know, after I was spoiled from being up here. But that stuff's going to go away. You know, it's the same thing that the Native folks and the Pinokis are thinking.
Well, exactly. And I was actually going to draw that parallel because, once again, where, and you know, Dr. Bill talked about that yesterday, talked about that story that you sent along to me about the activist, the Haudenosaunee activist up there in upstate New York.
Yeah.
He talked about that at length and then drew a conclusion I would never have drawn in a million years. And I didn't suggest it to him, and, you know, I'm sure if some right winger heard him, liberal. He suggested that John Marshall did not rule like he did in Johnson versus McIntosh out of some patriotic concern, but rather out of concern to make sure that the land speculators were okay.
Yeah.
Because for all we know, he may himself have been one of those land speculators. But the point I was going to get at is that there's a parallel to be drawn between a place like the Pinokis and that magnificent land up along the shores of Lake Superior and the land that you're talking about in upstate New York. Because in both of those cases, and you know I'm prone to waxing rhapsodic, which is a problem in and of itself, but you look at a region like that, and once you get the basic food and shelter and deal with the cold thing taken care of, you look up one generation and you go, well, damn, we're living in paradise.
Yeah.
You know, abundant fish, abundant game, abundant nut trees, what passed for the native pre-Columbian fruits that grew. I mean, you were set.
Yeah.
And I think that goes to what you wrote, John, about capitalism being self-destructive. Because, as you said, all that goes away. And the people of New York only get one chance to get this right. You cannot close this Pandora's box lid. And if the moratorium's lifted,
it's gone, and that's what I'm saying. It seems like an end game, you know, in chess. It's the last couple of moves. You know, you sacrifice a few things because you know you have a chance at winning, but then the game's over and the pieces get cleared off the board. But we don't work that way, you know. After the wells run dry, or more realistically, the price of natural gas falls so that it's not worthwhile to extract it anymore.
Which it's already doing.
The wells go away. The leases get voided in courts that are sympathetic to the big money, as you've mentioned. And what's left but fouled water and fouled air and fouled soil, where you can't grow a decent apple tree, you can't grow 20-foot-tall hops and make your beer. You can't rely on your municipal water supply or your wells anymore. Then what happens? I mean, you're more screwed than before.
Right. You know, I go back to that report out of Bonn, Germany last week, John. It said that, you know, a quarter of the Earth's population will be water insecure inside of a generation. And our tendency from looking through the lens of an American is to say, well, you know, Africa. Right? You know, Ethiopia, the Sahara.
Yeah.
Water. Yeah. No access to it. What happens when it's here? What happens when that water insecurity is us?
Yeah.
Because, see, you know, where you are, you know, near the mountains there of upstate New York, that's still the Appalachians. And it is still the most well-watered region in the entire United States. It's still the most biodiverse temperate rainforest in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes away. You know, all these climate deniers who say, well, no, we're going to have an ice age instead. Well, then you might want to take care of the place that reseeded the whole flipping continent after the last one.
Yeah, you might. And just speaking, one of your previous callers mentioned the Gasland, so there's a screening up here next week of the sequel, and I'm going to report too. Should be good. And the director's going to be here and be a Q&A, and I'm really expecting some gas flacks to be there because, you know, this is where I am is ground zero. I mean, they're saying this will be the center of New York State gas exploration if it goes forward.
And see, like,
fireworks,
like I said earlier, all you have to do is look down to Pennsylvania. I have a friend there who is a lawyer, and he does a lot of workers' compensation. And Pennsylvania law says that even if you're from out of state, if you're doing work in Pennsylvania, even if you've contracted otherwise, Pennsylvania's workers' compensation law controls. So my buddy is advertising for all he's worth, telling the frackers that if you get hurt on the job, come to me and we'll get your comp claim taken care of under Pennsylvania law. Because, and here's the secret about all those jobs, there aren't any Pennsylvania jobs. Or if they are, they are minuscule, rare. What there are a bunch of license plates from Texas and Oklahoma. And they live in hotels, and they drink hard, and they play hard, and they get hurt. But, you know, they go home when the job's done, or they go to the next well site. I mean, I've seen those Texas and Oklahoma plates here in West Virginia, because, see, we can, moratorium? This place? No. This place is the wild, wild west.
Yeah.
They are still drilling and fracking for all that they're worth. And I guess they think there's no need to worry about it, John, because, you know, mountaintop removal already took care of foul in the water.
So you got fracking there. I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Yeah. Okay. Big time. Yeah.
And I wanted to direct your attention. I don't know if you saw it yesterday or not, but Jeff Biggers, our friend Jeff Biggers, had a brilliant piece over at Huffington Post writing about a letter. When we hear frack, we tend to think New York, Pennsylvania, you know, this. But no, it's spreading like a cancer across this country. And they under consideration in the Illinois legislature is a fracking bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so lo and behold, Jeff wrote this story, you might want to look it up, about a letter sent to the legislature of the state of Illinois from people in Wisconsin and Minnesota and Iowa about what has been done to them, not from fracking, but from frac sand mining, which is very much like mountaintop removal.
Yeah, precursor. Exactly, right.
And, you know, their water, their air. And I like to think I had a little bit of a hand in that because, you know, it was up there starting at fighting Bob North up in Chippewa Falls, where I started trying to tell people they're going after a different substance, but this is the same process, the same explosives, the same poisons, and the same death. And they get
it. Yeah, I bet they do. It is, and it's. I mean, you can't quantify it, obviously, but I mean, it's maybe worse because the goal is to produce a substance that is then trucked to PA and possibly New York and West Virginia to use in the fracking process, which is itself destructive in a different way. So this touches on sort of my interest in chains of commodities and the movement of precursors to more destructive processes. Yeah, I did see that actually. He also made the point that, based on what's happened in PA, you know, you can't really say that there can be responsible fracking regulation because it just doesn't happen that way.
No, because they get to define John, the term responsible.
Exactly.
And responsible in the mind of a natural gas company is whatever gets the stuff out of the ground as cheaply and quickly as possible. That's responsible. Yeah. It's just like responsible mountaintop removal. Responsible is whatever it takes to get the coal out of the mountain and the money into the accounts.
Yep.
Well, I'm among other things, John, I'll be fascinated to hear your take on the screening of the second round of Gasland, because I've heard a few things through back channels that it's going to be nothing short of amazing.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. It's Tuesday, and I'll definitely make a report either by email or maybe call on Wednesday. I know you're in D.C. next week, right?
Right. I leave Sunday.
Great. Excellent. And, well, that's awesome work, and I'm very appreciative of your activism on that front. So I'll report back, but it's good talking to you, and hey to everybody in the commune.
All right. Thanks, John. It's awful good to hear from you.
Yeah, you bet. All right. Take care, Bob.
Bye now. And that's our buddy Dr. John. I don't know how to impress upon all of our consciousnesses any more or any more profoundly what is at stake here. You know, I've used the term Pandora's box. You only get to make the right decision once. And there's not a right decision except to say no. Because among other things, look up Jeff's work on Huffington Post, because back before, and this is one of those things that's deeply frustrating, back before this latest post that I was discussing with Dr. John, Jeff had a post talking about the fact that, and this is one of those moments where you just, you know, you face palm, talking about the fact that the Sierra Club is canoodling with the gas drilling industry in Illinois, trying to come up with, again, a responsible fracking bill. When, if anybody on planet Earth should understand it, it should be the Sierra Club, that there is no such thing as responsible fracking. Because frankly, if they think there's responsible fracking, then they must probably think that there's responsible mountaintop removal. You know, it's like that short distance between lawful and awful gun owner. How do you responsibly poison somebody? How do you responsibly send someone to their grave? I hear little snippets of information periodically that I'm not necessarily privy to share. I'll share it when I can. But there's data seemingly every day here in the sacrifice zone that shows us a little bit more and more clearly that something like mountaintop removal, the deaths that are occasioned by it you can't look at them anymore and say that that's negligence. You can't even say that it's gross negligence. It is intentional. It is homicide. And those homicides have names. And they have families. And histories. And their beloveds. I don't know what it's like where you are, wherever you are is. But I would simply like to ask a rhetorical question. No, it's not rhetorical. Now, this is not to say that Appalachia has problems that are greater than. This is not a competition. It's not a game. This is not to say that Appalachia's problems are worse than someone else's problems. But this is merely a descriptor of our reality. John talked about how beautiful it is in upstate New York right now in spring. It's been beautiful here too. And when this place is beautiful, it's like paradise. But once you know what people like my colleague Bo Webb and I know, once you know what people who have to live with mountaintop removal know, once you know what people who have to live and die with mountaintop removal know, it is a soul-scorching thing to walk out on your front porch in a rural setting that you chose for yourself, the sun peeking up from the first ridge and shining its first rays upon the day. And you take that first sweet, cool breath of morning. And then you realize, just breathed in some cancer-causing mountaintop removal pollution. And that's every breath. There's no break. There's no let up. It never ends. So I ask you non-rhetorically, what would that do to you? What would you do to make something like that stop? How would you respond to it, to know that there were people on tops of mountains setting off explosive charges because they feel like they've got a right to? They've got a right to poison people, kill people, so that they can put a check in their bank account. What would it do to you? Wouldn't you feel the hell heat of a fire under your ass that would make you go and do whatever was possible to make that end? That's the ACT Act. The only way I know of to end mountaintop removal, to take the poison out of the sky, and the poison out of the waters, and the poison out of the soil, and out of our homes, and out of our lives. And so that's why every night at the end of the program, I implore you to please go to ACACT.org, ACHEACT.org. And to contact your members of Congress, be they Republican or Democrat, and tell them that you want this sign, that you want this co-sponsored by them, that you insist that it be co-sponsored by them. Because it is intolerable to take your first breath of the morning and say, I'm being poisoned. Or take that first breath of the morning and say, my son's being poisoned. My daughters are being poisoned. My wife is being poisoned. My grandchildren are being poisoned. My neighbors are being poisoned. Even the people who poison us for money are themselves being poisoned. It's really the best hope we have, the ACAC. And as John noted, yeah, I'm going back to do ACE work next week in D.C. I will be on air as often as I possibly can. And I'll update you. We've had a lot of awesome work done by members of the Horn Family Commune, and we're following up on it. When you reach out to one of these people, shoot me a note and say, I've done that, so that I can then turn around and say, we're following up. Because you cannot imagine the power that it brings to the sense of urgency that attends this work to say, we're not just here for Appalachia. We're here because we know you've been contacted by your constituents and they want this thing to be passed. They insist that you sign this. They're past asking, they're telling. So do, please. It's about the only time that I ever ask you to, or give marching orders. Go to ACAC.org. If it's been a while since you wrote your rep and your rep hasn't signed on yet, write them again. If your rep has signed on, write to them and suggest that they reach out to their colleagues and get them signed on. Because, you know, not to fire up a chorus of poor, poor, pitiful me, but it ain't easy up there. And the more allies you have, the better the chances are. We're still getting almost zero support, with the exception of one really, really good individual in D.C. We're getting almost zero support from the Sierra Club. An outfit called Appalachian Voices in western North Carolina that has never had to deal with mountaintop removal once, that has never had to breathe the poison once, are actively working against the AIC Act because they didn't come up with it and they can't fundraise on it. The only way we're going to get this done is us. And what did Margaret Mead say? Never doubt that the good, determined actions of a few people can change the world. It is the only thing that ever has. I'm sure I've mangled that somehow or another, but it's close enough to the truth. Darlene writing in. Subject line, responsible. Responsible fracking. Responsible mountaintop removal. It's all the same meme, pretty much sanctioned by Obama and his administration, isn't it? Well, yeah. With his constant talk about clean coal, oxymoronic, 1984 doublespeak, or doublethink, sort of like Reagan calling the cruise missile the peacekeeper. Our illustrious leaders have been pulling this kind of crap forever and a day, haven't they? Yeah, they have, Darlene. Yeah, they have. And the only thing that will change it is the outraged, persistent voices of we the people. It's the only way. Waiting around for them to get it right? Well, we'll be dead by then. So, ACAC.org. Any help? Is deeply appreciated. Hey, look, I said I didn't know if I'd make it through prayer meeting Wednesday because I was feeling a little woozy and stupid. I've gotten pretty close. And we're getting pretty close. Still looking for the contributions that will fully match Waggy's challenge from yesterday evening. And we are at $60 to go on that. Any help you care to give is, well, it's what keeps this going. Head on radionetwork.com. That's where the PayPal button is. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Hey, Preston, how are you?
I'm doing all right.
Got a report back for us from Saturday?
I do. It was fantastic. I don't think it was 4,000 at any one point, but there were a lot of people coming and going, and by the time I was a little bit late myself, I think it started around 11, and I think I got there around noon, and I got to catch Jeffrey Smith. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he's been in a couple of the documentaries.
I recognize the name, but I can't specifically reference. But if he was there, I have no doubt his heart's in the right place.
Yeah, yeah. And he was sharing all kinds of important information. And as we both had expected, the libertarians were definitely there as well.
Were they really?
Yeah. And once again, handing out free documentaries about their theories that 9/11 was an inside job. And interestingly, they had packaged it. They had a free packet of seeds, and with the seeds, you'd get this documentary, this DVD, which again, I think it included one movie on genetic modification, which is worthwhile, but then there's this other one included with this package. And in this particular one, a friend of mine is actually in this one. So this is an issue that's not just, you know, out there in the political world. I'm running into this among a lot of people. And yeah, the more I'm looking into it, the more troubled I am. In fact, the group, there's a couple people with their InfoWars T-shirts, and I can,
oh, save me.
Yeah,
oh.
They do all the marketing. A lot.
Alex
of their,
wasn't there, was he?
Alex wannabes were there. A lot of his listeners, for sure.
Is Monsanto a false flag attack too?
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry. I don't mean to just be so dismissive, Preston, but I'm just so well past my tolerance level for this stuff.
I hear you, man.
I didn't play it because I didn't want to subject people to it, but I got a story in the Stack today about how Glenn Beck has declared that there's a conspiracy to make him look like a conspiracy nut. I mean, we're approaching levels of incomprehensible mathematics. A conspiracy, right, to prove he's a conspiracy.
Yeah.
Damn, I just want to crawl in the corner and suck my thumb.
The Bilderbergers strike again. Like.
Yeah, out there in the Bohemian Grove.
So, that doesn't surprise me.
Illuminati dancing in the moonlight.
Mm-hmm,
oh, please.
Mm-hmm. And so the InfoWars were there, and something called, a group called We Are Change. And again, kind of lifting from the famous Gandhi quote.
We are the change we want to be.
Right, be the change you wish to see in the world.
Yeah.
Or the market, the Mead quote you just cited. Let's make some change. So We Are Change, yay. And again, I go to their website.
Please, I'm so paranoid and weirded out, Preston. Go ahead and tell me that was an Orwellian name for the organization.
Largely, you know. Again, there's some stuff that I think is appealing to progressive spirits.
Well, there always is.
Yeah.
There's always with these hucksters and con artists. There's always a little soupçon, mm-hmm, of something for the progressives to get you pulled in. You know, look, it's like the drug dealer outside the school who says, "Hey, kid, the first one's free."
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Charlie Pierce, yeah, has the Paul family 5-minute rule, which I think is just brilliant.
Yeah.
And the way that works is he says that you can listen to either member of the Paul family speak for 5 minutes, and they will seem perfectly rational. At the 5-minute and 1-second mark, however, they will say something that is so utterly bat crazy that you realize that they are complete lunatics.
Yeah. Or staying with the drug dealer analogy, I'm thinking, hey kids, the first hit is marijuana, free, it's great, and then the next hit will be like meth or something, not so helpful. So, anyway, I went to their website, and so one of the things they had posted was a talk they had organized. I forget the person's name, but she's in Fort Collins, a town near and dear to my heart, and she was attacking the Fort Collins government, which is doing some just pioneering work regarding sustainability, mass transit, making it bike-friendly, and sustainability, bike-friendly. Oh, my gosh.
Communism.
Agenda 21, the UN global takeover. That was her narrative, was about Agenda 21, and there's a particular clause in it that she was trying to create all this fear around, and just ludicrous theories. And it was very much libertarian, corporatist. Again, be against government because these private interests want to go in there and take it over. It's interesting. In a sense, they're kind of co-opting anarchist language, where they're kind of like, less official government and kind of do our own voluntary mutual aid associations and stuff like that. But they're not talking anarchism. In fact, if you bring up the term, they totally flip out. It's this libertarian corporatism.
Yeah, but see, but the problem, Preston, is that they don't recognize that the heart and soul of pure capitalism, the heart and soul of libertarianism, the heart and soul of the so-called free market, the so-called corporatism, it's all anarchic. And I use that in its dictionary sense. It is because if you have regulation or you have order imposed upon the marketplace, well, then there are leaders. And anarchos, anarchy, comes from the Greek on, meaning without, and arch, you know, the leaders of ancient Greek cities were, like in Athens, were called the archons. Okay, so to be anarchic is to be without archons, which means that you are without a leadership structure.
Interesting. And yeah, that's very interesting. And anarchism is definitely something that we need to think more about.
It's
beyond socialism in terms of like verboten, you know, taboo.
Well, it's far more a political idea than it is an economic one. Because, for instance, the idea of anarchy, as I understand it, is not preclusive of democracy. Because democracy, pure democracy, again, is a collective voice of the will of the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got a pure democracy and nobody is leading it, it's making its decisions organically as a group.
Mm-hmm.
It's leaderless.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is thus still, within the purest term of the word, I think, anarchic.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard the web, the World Wide Web, the communication going on there has some anarchic qualities to it. You know, it isn't like NBC channel. It's people putting their own channels up.
Yeah, but by the same token, I don't necessarily hold with the idea that anarchy must be violent.
Right, right.
I don't think true anarchy is putting a brick through some shopkeeper's window.
Right, that's kind of a caricature of anarchism, and I think
a lot of
that kind of stuff were provocateurs.
Well, it's much more it's much more closely aligned with fascism, with brown shirts, with Mussolini's thugs. You know, they did that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Kristallnacht, anybody? You know.
I agree. Well, since we're on this topic, I wanted to mention a resource real quick, and one that I had a part in creating. It's something I had fun collaborating with somebody, actually. I was doing a local cable access program here in Denver, and sometimes I'd work with other cable access people in other cities, and I connected with somebody in Madison, and I knew Noam Chomsky was speaking there, and he did this little press conference with grassroots media people, or even professional media people. And anyway, I was able to get it recorded. I put it up on my little cable access show and kind of took the video and put it on my shelf and forgot about it. But with the development of social media and YouTube, I remembered it and connected with a friend. I'm not a very technical person at all, but friends of mine, you know, load things up to YouTube and loaded a talk. It's Noam Chomsky on anarchism. And it's about 50 minutes long. There are a couple things will come up, but this is kind of an informal Q&A. And the first question is on anarchism. And he talks about anarchism as basically in his questioning authority, you know, whether it's authority within a home or a workplace or, you know, country, just looking at authority. Questioning it, seeing if it can justify itself. In some instances, sometimes it can. Oftentimes it can't. You know, that's another aspect of anarchism. Then anarchism, I guess there is the economic aspect of it, or the, you know, the workers' organizations. I think a lot of them were anarchists. You know, some were socialists, some were anarchists. You know, there's kind of an effort at an anarchist revolution in Spain. They're going up against Francisco Franco and were put down pretty brutally. But so, you know, it comes in a lot of shapes and sizes. But anyway, something very different from libertarianism, for sure. And
These credit where credit is due, Preston. These libertarian info wars, Jonesers, birthers, deathers, tenthers, truthers, whatever, are very, very good at insinuating themselves into movements.
Yeah.
I personally think that they had a lot to do with why eventually in so many cities Occupy was so thoroughly suppressed.
I agree. And also I think why a lot of people got disenchanted with it. You know, they're picking up this material and hearing these raps, and people are just kind of going, ugh. You know, really?
Yeah, pass, thanks. Next.
Yep. And
well, I hate the fact that in our conversation on Friday, I jokingly said, well, keep an eye out for the InfoWars and the Libertarians and the Paulites. And, you know, I was kidding, kind of, halfway. And lo and behold, here it is, it's Wednesday evening, and you're telling me that, no, I was not kidding.
Yeah, you weren't.
And I guess there's an observation to be made. Denver being a Western city and the Western mindset being so radically different from the Eastern mindset or the Southern mindset, do you think that was more because, you know, Denver is Denver, or do you think that maybe, you know, the one that had 3,000 people in Miami or whatever it was equally corrupted? And corrupted's probably the wrong word.
I would imagine, well, it's certainly a nationwide effort. I've had, you know, friends on Facebook share their experiences. You know, someone in Austin gets a big dose of it because Alex Jones is based in Austin. But they're all over for sure. But I don't know if some cities have a more pronounced, more active or a group of them. Denver's is active for sure. So I can't say if it's larger than in other towns. I will say this though, on the bright side of things, there was so much more going on there than the We Are Change group and the InfoWars. They said they passed out all their stuff. But there are other people there passing out other kinds of material. There was a farmer there, and he had set up a little card table with some samples of the soil that he sells, and it's kind of like a socially responsible business. It's called Maxfield Soil, and I just actually purchased some of their soil from the Whole Foods, and I read about it beforehand, and what they're doing is great, radical stuff, and healthy for the dirt, and great for your plants. I just put my tomato plant in it. And anyway, he was giving, you know, an informal workshop about soil health, food health, health of the earth, and so there's that going on. The speakers, I didn't hear all the speakers, and I don't know if a libertarian got up there. They probably were up there too, but most of the speakers were talking about other issues. You know, keeping, instead of worrying about nanothermite at WTC.
Again, we discussed last week when you called in that graphic you see on the internet with the guy with his hand on his head from the 50s. The guy with his hand on his head, oh, no, not this shit again.
Okay.
You know, no, I'm not saying that to you, but you know,
right.
There are some things out there that just bring on Excedrin headache number what the...
Right. You know, I was thinking about the genetic modification issue, and I'm thinking, well, the Kochs are behind this. People should realize this. Alex Jones promotes a magazine called New American, which is published by the John Birch Society. And the John Birch Society was founded by the father of the Koch brothers, or at least partially.
Well, he certainly funded it.
Yes, you bet. Okay, so, and they've been trafficking in these sorts of conspiracy theories for quite some time. And then the anti-UN theme, that's a big one. But anyway, the Kochs, you know, GMOs, that's not their thing. That's not their racket. That's, in fact, that's Bill Gates' racket and
yeah.
other people. And so I'm,
and the and the word racket is appropriately used.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe they're even trying to kind of little doing some industrial undercutting of their other competitor billionaire. And, you know, the Kochs are more into, you know, natural gas stuff and fertilizer and, you know, and that's where the climate theory hoax that, you know, they're pushing, Alex Jones pushes this climate change is a hoax. That's another conspiracy theory. Okay, now that does affect the Kochs' financial interests. And there's Alex Jones. He'll go on and on about Soros. But I just out of curiosity, I typed in Alex Jones and the Koch brothers. And up pops this scene of him talking about it. And he was dismissive of it. He says something to the effect, oh, it's become very fashionable for people to attack the Koch brothers. My gosh.
Yeah, because it's just like it's just like following the next fad in necktie colors.
Yeah, yeah. And he wants to, you know, decrease that movement against the Koch brothers because he's serving the Koch brothers. Whip them up against George Soros day in and day out. Oh, yeah. Because Soros, every now and again, you know, of course, he has all sorts of ill-gotten gains himself, but he does take some of his loot and put it into things like, well, there's something called like the Open Society. It's some kind of think tank kind of thing. And most of the time,
Open Society is actually one of those organizations that, if I'm not mistaken, is actually funded by George Soros.
He does. He's put some money into it. And I
applaud that.
I do too, because even if I don't, I'm not interested in a lot of their work or even disagree with it, I did see them do things. I have seen them do things. Like, they hosted this author who wrote a book about offshore bank accounts. It's called Treasure Islands, about all those, you know, corporations moving their money offshore and how much that's costing the country and that kind of thing. You know, so the Open Society will do things like that. Soros has also been kind of a Daddy Warbucks of the marijuana legalization movement. And a lot of these libertarians who have been whipped up against Soros, if they knew that, they might be able to see the broader picture and not just a caricature of the guy. And, you know, other issues like that. So Soros and DeBeck and like Jones, they'll go after him, but the Kochs, not so much. But, again, back to the March on Monsanto Denver. It was bigger than the We Are Change thing. I mean, I was disappointed they were there and they've misled a bunch of people with their material. But there are a lot of discussions going on there. And I was fortunate to have a bunch of my own DVDs to hand out for free. Not so many, but I had a good time handing out the ones I did pass around, which included The Last Mountain. And I had one on organic farming called Fresh, which focuses on this organic farmer, Joel Salatin. I think he's in Virginia. Awesome guy. And I handed out something else, a couple others. I had all kinds of stuff. And through that, got to connect and network with all kinds of interesting people. And this lady from Iran, who's been organizing these social forums here in Denver. The last one they did was on the prison industrial complex, and we got to talking a lot about politics. And then at one point we were talking about inspiration, where we kind of keep the fires burning, you know. And I mentioned how I got a lot of inspiration out of Rumi, and she's from Iran, and
right.
Rumi, you know, it's from that area. And it turns out she's a Sufi, and something of a Rumi. Well, she gets together every month with her friends, and they just talk about Rumi's poetry. And
you can spend a lot of time talking about Rumi's poetry. I've got a book of it here, and I read it from time to time, and it just blows me away.
Yeah, and so moments like that, kids all over the place having a good time, The police were totally helpful. We marched right through the center of town and back again, and we sat in the street a couple times, and no confrontations with the cops, and they were helpful along the way. And someone said, you know, a lot of them probably wanted to join in. So there's opportunity in this mix. You know, if we are Change and Jones, and if they're bringing kind of a different sort of audience here, a lot of them right-wingers, we can actually take advantage of that, because who I was handing DVDs to was not all progressive people at all. There were people who had never heard of Howard Zinn, and people who were interested in a documentary about Ralph Nader, An Unreasonable Man, is that one. So, and in fact, right before I left, I got invited to a barbecue by these people, and who I come to find out are kind of libertarians and are kind of involved in this We Are Change group. Not directly, they're not leaders of it, but they've just been, you know, they've found some common ground with it. And I went to this barbecue the next day filled with libertarians, and there are definitely people who are not totally committed to that cause at all and are open to a more green socialist.
Yeah, sometimes it's a matter of who gets to you first, Preston.
Yeah.
Because everybody wants to be right about something. Everybody wants to be on the winning side. Everybody wants to feel like their life was purposeful, you know, as long as you're not just completely sucked into the corporate consumerist matrix.
Yeah, make some kind of contribution, you know. So, it was a good time. And then on Facebook, I, you know, got to share some material and see the photos from all the other protests going on around the country, around the world. That was great. Oh, and this one person at the Denver march, they took this photo of these two young, they were, I'd say 13, 14-year-old, maybe younger, actually. Anyway, they had this sign, very artfully done, and it said, stop the food dictatorship. And above the quote, they had this head, with kind of this like third eye dot, and it was Vandana Shiva, actually. It was an image of her, who's, you know, she's speaking of Gandhi,
right?
Vandana Shiva, yeah. So it's fun to see Vandana on a protest sign, and but yeah, all kinds of stuff floating around Facebook. We got some decent local coverage. I don't know if it made the national news, but a couple local TV stations did a, you know, they weren't making fun of us. They kind of they did a fair job of representing the scene, and the public radio station gave us some airtime, and so yeah, it worked out beautifully, really. So anyway,
well, it sounds like it was time well worth the spending, Preston. I'm really glad that you reported back. By the way, a little fan mail coming in from Jim. He said, Preston has a really good voice for radio. Really.
Oh, that's nice to say.
But no, I mean, we refer to you as the Horn's resident optimist. And it's true. And we need that optimism, and we need that sense that things are fixable. Because I got to tell you, sometimes, I mean, I go for some pretty profound long-term wallows here, and nihilism is an easy place to go. Bless his heart, he is as smart as any human being can be, brilliant and committed. And I've met and talked with him personally. I have tremendous respect for him. But, you know, the nihilism of Chris Hedges, for instance.
Yeah.
Is tough.
Yeah, and there's an element of truth to it, and I feel it myself. And you know, I think some things I'm not optimistic about. Some things are going to be lost. But in other moments, with some topics, there are opportunities. There are definitely possibilities of all sorts. I just was learning the other day about, you know, there's all this talk about carbon sequestration and, you know, it's high-tech fixes people are trying to make money off of. But, you know, just particular trees, the amount of carbon dioxide that dense, you know, hardwood trees pull in, it's remarkable.
Yeah.
So, you know, possibilities like that. And locally, I read recently that somebody saw for the first time in decades I think it was a river otter in the Boulder Creek.
Wow.
Yeah, they had been hunted to extermination.
Well, and let me just, you talk about those little green initiatives and things. I was kind of surprised. I mentioned the other night that I was, yes, watching the NASCAR race on Sunday, which, of course, is broadcast by Fox. Please, no hate mail. And, of course, yeah, they did their salute to freedom ceremony featuring Oliver North, and the goddess of irony, took care of them for that by making their camera fall down and nearly ruin a perfectly good race car. But in the breaks, they ran these promos from time to time for what they call NASCAR Green. Now, again, this is NASCAR that has an exclusive broadcast gig with Rupert Murdoch's Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, climate science denying Fox, conspiracy theory espousing Fox, mm-hmm. And you know, if they've got Oliver North at a freaking race, you know that the ideological lines are pretty well blurred. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but lo and behold, they're talking about how they've got a racetrack that is entirely solar powered. They've got the biggest recycling program of any major sport.
I'll take it.
I'm sitting there going, really? Because you know, my paranoid little mind goes, come on, I smell some greenwashing.
Yeah, there's certainly some of that going on too.
But if any of it's real,
yeah,
hurrah! Like, because you know, sending 40 cars around a mile and a half oval 400 times.
Mm-hmm.
It's gonna be a little carbon intensive.
Yeah.
I'm looking to the day when, you know, 200 mile an hour Teslas are out there.
Right, and if we are going to use, you know, this energy for, you know, the foreseeable, you know, let's use them in practical, useful ways, and not, you know, driving around in circles. I don't know if that's so good. But yeah, if they could apply some of these, like you said, solar, they're doing some solar, and you know, they've got a lot of money to invest and some minds, you know, in their engineering department, and who knows, maybe some of what they're doing will find its way to, you know, the general public. You know, just like in the military, I can't stand a lot of the military spending and what a lot of the.
But they're doing some of the most profound environmental work, eco work.
There's that, and they developed the internet. You know, that was out of the Defense Advanced Research Project.
Hey, remember that National Military Defense Highway System?
Yeah.
Interstates.
So
the only way you could get the Republicans in 1950 to sign off on the idea of actually replacing two lane roads with four lane thoroughfares was not to tell them, well, you know, this will be good for business. This will be good for Mr. and Mrs. America. No. This will be great for the military. Soviets don't have one of these.
Yeah.
Right. Well, hey, Preston, I hate to do it, but I got to get out of here because we are right up against it.
Okay, we'll chat again soon.
All right, take care, Preston.
You too, man.
Bye.
Bye.
And so we closed the program this evening about $60 short of hitting Waggy's $150 challenge, but that stays on the table and back tomorrow as long as the inner tubes hold out. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. Thanks to our all volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and yes, as previously referenced, acheact.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Here comes Rick Smith on the horn.